Amitabha and his Pure Land Sukhavati. Where did all that come from, really? So it's a Mahayana concept, idea. And do you know about Mahayana? Do you know what Mahayana is? Okay. So let's go right back to the Buddha. In the Buddha's day, there was just the Buddha. You could even go as far to say the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. He was just the Buddha. He was the Buddha means the awakened one, the one who is awake. Literally, it just means the awake. So the Buddha was the awake. And that's how it all began, really. He awakened to reality. And some weeks, months later, he started to try to teach people about that and how to get there themselves. And then they did. Loads of people. It's amazing. Loads of people began to awaken. And so probably by the end of his life, he must have had hundreds of what are called arahants. So an arahant is an awakened person, as awakened as the Buddha, but they're called arahants because they wanted to distinguish the Buddha as someone special, you know, because he did it first. But he would say to people time and time again, what I've done, you can do. And then when you've done that, you're as awakened as I am. So that was early Buddhism. And there was just one Buddha and lots of arahants. And then loads and loads of other people following the Buddha who hadn't fully awakened yet. That's a simple story. But then as time went on, people began to feel that the Buddha was really, really special. And of course, in those very early days, he was just merely, as it were, a human being who'd awakened to the truth. That's the human understanding of the Buddha. You could almost say the humanist understanding of the Buddha. But later on, they began to feel that the Buddha was more special than that. And they began to conceive of him in a kind of cosmic way. And in doing that, what they did is they said, actually, the Buddha is one Buddha in a line of Buddhas, going way, way back. So you get this idea of a previous Buddha called Dipankara. Now, the previous Buddha, Dipankara, lived a long, long time ago. Let me just give you some idea of how long ago he lived. If I can open this. So, for instance, in the longer Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, say more about that later. Oh, Dharmagiri's just popped up, look. None of your preferred networks are available. Dharmagiri, goodbye. So, here's the Buddha speaking to Ananda in the longer Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra. In a former age, Ananda, in the distant past, innumerable. Do you know what innumerable means? Can't be numbered. And more than innumerable. How can you have more than innumerable? But anyway, innumerable and more than innumerable. Let's say countless and more than countless. Measureless. Countless. Inconceivable. You could even say unimaginable. Cosmic ages. So what's a cosmic age? A cosmic age is a kalpa. Do you know how long a kalpa is? A kalpa. Okay, you can't really measure a kalpa in years. So there's Mount Sumeru. Do you know Mount Sumeru? Massive mountain. Let's say as big as Everest, right? So every 100 years, a goddess floats down from the heavens and just brushes the mountain with a piece of Benares silk and goes back up again. Then 100 years later, she comes back and does it again. How long would it take for that mountain to be worn down to nothing just doing that? That's how long a kalpa is. Yeah. So, how many kalpas? Innumerable, and more than innumerable, measureless, countless, inconceivable kalpas before now. Yeah. Now that is a long time, isn't it? There appeared a Tathagata, perfect full Buddha called Dipankara. So that's the previous Buddha. So you can see what they were doing. They were conceiving of the Buddha as being this, in part of a lineage, but this kind of cosmic lineage, which is unimaginable. You can't possibly think about that length of time, way, way back. And then after a while, they had six previous Buddhas. And then, let me just get this right. And then there were 14, then 23, and then more. So way, 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 way back like that. And the Buddha was the final one, as it were. Final one as far as we're concerned, because then they came up with this idea of a future Buddha, and you get this idea of Maitreya. You've heard of Maitreya. Maitreya at the moment is a bodhisattva, and he's not fully enlightened yet. And it's going to take, innumerable, more than innumerable, measureless, countless, inconceivable, cosmic ages in the future before Maitreya is fully enlightened. Right. So you get a few people around these days who call themselves Maitreya, don't you? I'm the one. Can't possibly be right. It's only 2,000 years after the Buddha. So that can't possibly be Maitreya, the Buddha. Yeah. So that's what you get. You get this great long... So now the Buddhists were thinking... Whoa, what was that? It's only my glasses case, right? The Buddhists were now thinking incredibly long periods of time. And we're just this tiny little snapshot. So our lifetime is a tiny snapshot in amongst all this massive, long periods of time. Do you get the idea? Even later, with the rise of the Mahayana. So Mahayana means the great way, or the great vehicle to enlightenment. And you get this whole idea of... you see, what the Buddha did, in this cosmic understanding of our Buddha, I have to now call him our Buddha, because there's always other Buddhas from the past and the future. Our Buddha. When Dipankara was alive, all those cosmic ages ago, our Buddha was just an ordinary person who met Dipankara and decided he wanted to do what Dipankara did. Yeah. What did Dipankara do? Dipankara was born in a world system where there was no Buddhism, no Buddha. And he, as it were, rediscovered the Dharma afresh for people and started teaching. Now, the Buddha wanted to do that. Our Buddha wanted to do that. So he held off his enlightenment. He could have got enlightened there and then with Dipankara. But he said, no, I want to hold off my enlightenment. I want to practice for cosmic ages, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. And then be reborn in a world system where there's no Buddhism and introduce the Dharma to the beings in that world system. Yeah. Now, what was the Buddha called, our Buddha called, before he was enlightened? Yeah. He was a bodhisattva. Pali, bodhisattva. Sanskrit, bodhisattva. So a bodhisattva is a Buddha in the making. Yeah. They're on their way to Buddhahood. Not arahantship. Yeah. Do you get that distinction? They're on the way to Buddhahood. So now you get this idea of a bodhisattva. So with the rise of the Mahayana, 400-500 years after the Buddha, people began to think, I want to do that actually. I don't want to gain enlightenment now in this life, because I'll gain enlightenment, I'll become an arahant, I'll teach and then I'll die, and that will be it. What I want to do is much bigger than that, much greater idea of gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings in a land, Buddha field, or field, world system, where there are no Buddhists, there's no Buddha. Yeah, I want to introduce the Dharma to people afresh. Do you get the idea? So now you've got these two ideals, really. You've got almost these two kinds of disciples. There's those disciples who just want to follow the Buddha and gain enlightenment in this life under the stewardship of the Buddha. Then you get these others who say, no, I don't want to gain enlightenment in this life. I want to do exactly what the Buddha did. Yeah? So the Mahayana is made up of those people in the second category, the people who want to become bodhisattvas, who want to introduce the Dharma to people in cosmic ages in the future. So they hold off their enlightenment. Yeah? Yep, following me so far? So that's... Now, the Mahayana used to call the followers of the other tradition the Shravaka Yana. Shravaka is listener. They listen to the Buddha and they gain enlightenment. Later on, unfortunately, a bit later on, they began to call them the Hinayana. Now, Hina is a very pejorative term, derogatory, almost insulting term. It means small. But it means more than small, it means petty, small-minded, low. Yeah. So they must have started arguing. Maybe the people who were just trying to gain enlightenment in this life thought that the Mahayanists were too big for their boots. Maybe they thought, well, who do you think you are? And they began to insult them, perhaps. And the Mahayana, in their turn, began to insult the others. I don't know what happened, but you get some Mahayana sutras, don't you, where they're just talking about enlightenment and Buddhists and the Dharma in a normal kind of way, and then suddenly they get into this thing about the Hinayana. Have you noticed that? And it's almost like they start getting into a kind of a rant. You know when you're talking to a friend and suddenly your friend starts talking, you mention somebody, and your friend starts ranting on about them. You had that experience? The trouble with that person is blah, blah, blah. It's a little bit like that when you read the Mahayana Sutras. You're going along quite nicely and suddenly, boah. But that's the later Mahayana Sutras. The earlier Mahayana Sutras, there doesn't seem to be any problem between the two camps. There doesn't seem to be any tension between them. And the Pure Land Sutras are like that. They refer to the followers of the Buddha who are trying to gain enlightenment in this life as the Shravaka Yana. And then there's the Mahayana. Right, are you with me so far?
Shravaka means...
listener, hearer. Comes from the word sutta, to hear. Yeah? Shravaka. And that's what the Buddha's early disciples were called. They were called the Shravakas. Yeah? So far, so good. So then, but what the Mahayana did, they multiplied those Buddhas. So in the beginning of the longer Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, which is a Mahayana Sutra, you get 80 Buddhas of the past. 80 Buddhas of the past, each one born innumerable and more than innumerable, etc., etc., before the previous one. So you've got this massive, completely unthinkable time span. Yeah. They did more than that, though. Now, up until then, there was only room for one Buddha at a time. You couldn't have two Buddhas at one time, so only one Buddha at a time. But what the Mahayana did, they said, yeah, only one Buddha in this particular world system. Yeah. What is a world system? A world system is more or less a galaxy. Yeah. Of course, in India 2,000 years ago, they didn't have scientific knowledge. So, it's very, very roughly when I say a world system is a galaxy. But it's more than just a land or a world. It's a world system. You can only have one Buddha in one world system. But they came up with this idea of the 3,000 great thousand world realm. 3,000 great thousand. So they had this idea of many, many world systems existing at the same time. Yeah. Maybe a little bit like the modern idea of the multiverse. You know, until recently we've been thinking of the universe, now this idea of the multiverse. Perhaps a little bit like that. Perhaps not. But anyway, massive, not only time spans, but space. You know, massive, unthinkable space. So millions of world systems going on. Some of these world systems without a Buddha. Yeah, no Buddha in them. some world systems with a Buddha. And they are called Buddha fields. Yeah. Two kinds of Buddha fields. Impure Buddha fields and pure Buddha fields. We live in an impure Buddha field. An impure Buddha field includes all six realms of existence. Do you know what I mean by the six realms of existence? No. Okay, the human realm, the animal realm, the realm of the hungry ghosts, the realm of the hell beings, so different hells, the realm of the gods, or the realms of the gods, 33 realms of gods, and the realms of the anti-gods, or the angry, jealous gods. Too much to go into all that now. Four of those realms are realms of suffering. The animals, the hells, obviously, the hungry ghosts, and the anti-gods. Have I said that already?
No.
I did. Let's start again.
You mentioned four. Yeah.
Okay, so they're all realms of suffering. So we have those in this world. And you know that because you've experienced them. You've experienced hell, yeah, of various kinds, haven't you? You've experienced the breakup of a relationship. You've experienced the death of a loved one. You've experienced cruel disappointment. You've also experienced the realm of the hungry ghosts. You've experienced great craving, craving that cannot be satisfied. You've experienced that. We've all experienced the six realms. So we live in an impure Buddha field. But there are pure Buddha fields.
Do you want questions during the talk?
Yeah, I don't mind. I don't mind, no.
But supposedly when the Buddha lived, if that was a pure Buddha field...
No.
No, that wasn't.
No, no. This is an impure Buddha field.
Even when,
yeah.
When the Buddha lived?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you can still have arahants and bodhisattvas?
Yes, you can. Yeah, yeah. But it's a Buddha field. It's a Buddha field. So you can gain enlightenment in a Buddha field, but it's a realm of suffering as well as happiness. So it's got both, suffering and happiness. Now, you've got the gods as well. The devas, they live in realms of complete happiness. I'll say more about that in a moment, about that. And then you've got the humans, which span both. A human realm has both suffering and happiness, as you know. Yeah. Pure Buddha fields only have two realms, human and gods. Where does
Buddhas don't fit into humans or gods or...
Oh, well, the Buddhas are... The Buddhas are kind of human gods in a way. Yeah. They don't really fit into any particular category. They're Buddhas. Different category, yeah. Different category, you could say, yeah. So, when it comes to Amitabha, Amitabha is one of these Buddhas who lives now in Sukhavati, which is a Buddha field, a galaxy, millions of galaxies away to the west. Where's the west from here? Okay. That way. All right. Okay. But it's the mythical west. It's the mythical west. Yeah, it's not really the West in geographical terms. One of the interesting things about this is if we were to travel to the West now and we kept on going, we'd go all the way around the world and we'd end up back where we were. Yeah. But if you go in space to the West, you don't end up back where you were. You go on and on and on and on and on. Yeah. But it's so far away. Yeah. Amitabha's Pure Land is so far away that there's no way that you can reach it. Yeah. Even if you got into this amazing spaceship that travelled faster than time, faster than, what's the, Yeah, far. You would never get there. It's so far away that, you know, you'd be dead before you actually got there. Yeah. So there's a symbol behind that, which I'm not going to spell out to you. You can work that out yourself. Yeah. So that's Amitabha's pure land. Yeah, and he purified. So that's what these Buddhas do. They purify their world system they go into. They make it so that there is no suffering there. No hells, no hungry ghosts, no anti-gods, no animals. That was the one I missed out, the animal realm. No animals. Yeah. So a pure Buddha field is pure Dharma, you could say. It's the pure Dharma. It's a place where all you get is the Buddha, enlightened beings, bodhisattvas, beings who are irreversible from enlightenment. You know, the irreversible, you can't fall back. And the only thing they do is they practice the Dharma. And they hear the Dharma in everything. Yeah. In the Shorter Sukhavati Viyuha Sutra, you get, it's fantastic actually, you get the whole place is surrounded by trees, seven rows of trees. The trees are made of coral and diamond and ruby and sapphire and emerald. Yeah. The trunks of the trees are gold with silver branches and sapphire leaves, or sapphire trunks with golden branches and ruby leaves. So you get all this going on, all surrounding the whole place. And there are nets of jewels surrounding. And whenever the wind blows, you get this most beautiful music. Yeah? And when you hear this music, the music is spelled out. The music is of as if you had the most skilled musicians playing in an orchestra. You just hear that. And when you hear that, your body is suffused with your recollection of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Get that. You hear this music and your body is suffused with the recollection, the remembrance of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And the Buddha makes it clear that their whole bodies remember. Or they remember the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha with their whole bodies, yeah, the beings in that land. So it's not only a place of Dharma, it's a place of Sangha. You could say that the Pure Land is Sangha taken to its ideal limit. Yeah. So the nearest we can get that to that is going on retreat, yeah, where the trees are silver birch. And whatever you have here, I don't know.
Everyone is singing.
Yeah. We'll have that this evening. That's why I've brought the sounds of the Pure Land. We'll listen to the sounds this evening, all being well, if we can set it up properly. And then you get birds. Now, you're not supposed to have birds in a Pure Land because the animal realm doesn't exist. So the Buddha makes it clear that the birds are magical birds. Yeah. Three kinds of magical birds, three times a day, swoop down from the sky. And they don't just tweet or squawk or quack. They teach you the Dharma. They're teaching you the Dharma three times a day. Yeah. So we'll hear this later on this evening. We'll hear this. So that's what a Pure Land is. The Pure Land is a place of pure Dharma, pure Sangha. Interesting thing about the Pure Land Sutras. There are four that I draw upon, four sutras that I draw upon. The Buddha, at least in the main three, Amitabha doesn't really say anything. He just sits there being a Buddha. And the Dharma is taught through the land. The land, the trees, the jewels, the birds. They teach you the Dharma. So it's almost as if the beings in the Pure Land have gone beyond the need for conceptualization. They don't need words. They don't need to hear the Four Noble Truths, etc. They don't really need that anymore. They got that Now they just need to suffuse themselves in the Dharma. And the land is described in great detail. You get these trees, but you get the ground, which is variously, it could be lapis lazuli or turquoise with golden cords running through it, or it could be golden, complete gold ground, lotus ponds with lotuses the size of cartwheels, some blue, intense blue, some red, intense red, some white, intense white. And you can go into that, you can walk into those ponds, and you can have the ponds come right up here or down there. It depends just how you think, you know, you imagine. You just allow the ponds to completely suffuse your body with them, and so on. So the whole thing is Dharma. I kind of think that the land itself, actually I've got this talk on here which I'm just not following, so I might as well put it down there. I kind of think that land itself is jhana or samadhi. Do you know what I mean by that? Jhana, which is the meditative absorptions, yeah, which are pleasant, which are beautiful, which are deep happiness and contentment and joy. So you've got, you're surrounded, you're in, surrounded by, you're immersed in, submerged in this jhanic-like state of beauty and imagination. And what happens then is the Dharma comes through. Just like in classic early Buddhism, the Buddha said, first, you need to go into the forest. You need viveka. You need viveka. You need solitude. Now, solitude, viveka, might as well talk about viveka while you're here. It doesn't just mean solitude in the physical sense of going away into the forest on your own, but it also has a mental sense to it. Singleness of mind. In the Pali Dictionary, viveka is also singleness of heart. Yeah. So it means that you're really, the Buddha was saying that you need to, you know, bring yourself together in a singleness, a totality, a wholeness. And then comes jhana. Yeah. And then out of jhana, you reflect on the Dharma. Yeah. So the Pure Land is that teaching, but imaginatively understood. So the Pure Land is jhana, out of which comes the Dharma. Yeah, insight comes there. Do you get the idea? And Amitabha just sits there. I've been calling him Amitabha. He has two names, Amitabha and Amitayus. Amita is the root word of his, root part of his name. Amita means measureless, cannot be measured, therefore boundless, without boundaries, without borders, limitless, infinite. So Abha means light, so infinite light or measureless light, or Amitayus, infinite life. So space and time, again, just the expansion of space and time to infinity and eternity. That's what we're doing this weekend. That's our task, to try to immerse ourselves even a little bit in this kind of imaginative world. His land is Sukhavati. Sukhavati. Vati, to be honest, I can't remember what Vati means now. Never mind. I think it means... Never mind, I'll come back to that later. But sukha is the important word. Sukha, you know sukha. Sukha means pleasure. It means happiness. It's the opposite of dukkha. Dukkha is everything unpleasant. Anything from mild dissatisfaction with a conversation, feeling a bit bored here, to the utter pain of, I don't know, physical pain of torture. So it's everything. Dukkha is all unpleasantness in the world. Sukha is the opposite of that. So it's anything that's pleasant. So it can be the pleasant of just scratching an eye that's itching. Oh, that's better. That's sukha. Right through to the utter happiness of enlightenment. So sukha is everything like that. So it's sukha is pleasure and happiness. So I'm going to go back to my... I'm going to read you something from the Dhammapada. You know? Dhammapada? You know the Dhammapada, I'm sure. It's Dharmagiri again. Goodbye. Where are we? So the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, if by giving up a limited happiness, one would see an abundant happiness, let the spiritually mature person, having regard to the abundant happiness, sacrifice a limited happiness. This is Bhante's translation, and it's a little bit old-fashioned, but basically what the Buddha is saying is, you've got a limited happiness, and you've got this tremendous big happiness. What are you going to do? Are you going to go for the small happiness, or would you prefer to go for the big one? Well, you want the big one, don't you? To get from the little one to the big one, though, you've got to give up the little one. And that's where we stop, because, ooh, but I like this little one here. I like having this little these little pleasures. Well, if you want those little pleasures, you can't have the big happiness. Yeah. You can't have everything. So that's a very important teaching, I think. You've got an idea of a limited happiness, small happiness, and you've got an idea of an abundant, big. Abundant is a great English word. It means like flowing over. Large, like this, abundant. So which one do you want? We Buddhists want the big one, don't we? But we haven't got there yet because we're kind of stuck in the little one. And that's why renunciation is so important. Essential renunciation. But we find that hard to take, don't we? We don't really want to renounce. We'd like the big one and keep the little one as well. Can't we have both? The big one and the little one. The Buddha would say, if he could, yeah, have both, but it doesn't. The world doesn't work like that. So then in another sutta, the Nyiramisa Sutta, the Buddha talks about 12 levels of happiness. Now this is really good, the 12 levels of happiness. Three main levels, each of the three main levels split up into four. Yeah. Shall I write this up on the board? Yes. Would that be helpful? Okay, can I use these pens on this board? Yeah, they're okay. Let's use blue. Is blue a good thing? Yeah, you can see blue on here. So, get out of this jewel tree here. So you've got first of all, we've got worldly happiness. Actually, the word is misa, which means flesh. Yeah. Actually, it means meat. It's the happiness of meat, the meaty happiness, which is flesh happiness, fleshly happiness, which is the world, often translated as world, the happiness of the world. So that's the first one. Then you've got unworldly. So amisa. Happiness not of this world. And then you've got greater than unworldly. Yeah? Greater. So worldly, unworldly, greater than unworldly. Worldly happiness is the kind of happiness that we get in the world. We get a job we want and we're happy. We fall in love and we're happy. We go to a massage parlour and we get massage and it feels great. And that's all here. So worldly happiness is the happiness of the world. It's physical pleasure. It's all that kind of stuff. It's the happiness of the Kama Loka. Yeah? The three, you know, in Buddhism you get three worlds, the Kama Loka, the world of sense pleasures. Then the unworldly happiness is Jhana. Yeah, it's the happiness of high states of consciousness, meditative absorption. And greater than unworldly is insight, it's wisdom. Yeah. So those are the three types of happiness, and as I say, each one is divided into three. Why don't I use green for there? Into four. So you've got joy. Joy is a translation of priti. Priti, yeah? So in the first jhana, you get priti, which is that feeling of physical pleasure when Bansi calls it tension release, that feeling of, you know, that lovely feeling that when you at last begin to settle down into meditation, you become a bit concentrated, you feel this sort of welling up of pleasure in your body, and you can actually feel it in your body, can't you? You know the kind of thing? Sometimes when you're moved, watching a movie, and towards the end it all comes together, and you just feel, you might even cry, and it's, that's priti. Five levels of priti, of course, but that's too much information. And then there's, that's priti, and then there's sukha. I'm not going to translate that, because we know what sukha is. Sukha is happy. You could say happiness, but it's a deeper kind of happiness. This joy is kind of up, excited, happy. But this is a deeper kind of happiness. You could, let's say, joy is like falling in love. Sukha is like 2 or 3 years later, you're not really in love anymore, but you've got to know each other and there's a kind of companionship, you know, a nice deep felt companionship between you. Do you get the difference between the two? Or joy is just, you've got your new job, you think, yeah, great. 3 years later, you're used to having your new job, but you still get a lot out of it. You're just quietly getting on with the job that you love to do. Yeah? The trouble is with this kind of happiness and concern, it's if it's opposite. Yeah? So one of the things about dukkha is the Buddha said dukkha is not getting what you want. But Edward Conza went on to say, well, also, it's getting what you want and then sometimes later realising you don't really want it after all. That's another aspect of dukkha. Then the next one. What's the next one? Oh, yeah, equanimity. The next one is equanimity. Funny old English word, it's not often used, equanimity. Comes from two words, equus and animus. Equus meaning equal, balanced, and animus meaning your soul. Your inner being, so a kind of inner balance. So equanimity is when you don't really mind anymore. Yeah, you're so happy that you don't really mind what happens. You know, you've just missed your train, or you've got on the train and you realise you've gone to the wrong place. You're on the wrong train, or you realise you spent £100 on your tickets and you've lost them. Yeah, it's what happened to me on Tuesday. My tickets, I spent hours trying to get these tickets 2 months ago to get cheap tickets, and I'd lost them. So I had to buy them all over again. And equanimity is when you go, what can you do? Mm-hmm. And you're still happy. Yeah. Difficult, that, isn't it? And then finally, freedom. Freedom is when you really, really don't mind at all what happens. You're happy no matter what happens. So you're free from the tyranny of pleasure and pain. you really don't mind what's happening. Yeah, you're beyond the need for things to go your way. And this happens in each one of these. You've got the joy, sukha, equanimity and freedom of worldly happiness. You've got the joy, sukha, equanimity of unworldly happiness. And we know that because that's like going through the jhanas, isn't it? Joy, sukha, equanimity, freedom. Yeah. Freedom, actually, these three are to do with the... For those of... This is very technical now, for those of you who really know your Dharma. Joy, sukha and equanimity are the jhanas of the world of form. And freedom is are the four jhanas of the formless world. Don't worry if you're completely lost here. And then greater than, this is insight. Yeah, this is when you gain insight into the Dharma. And then your joy, sukha, equanimity and freedom are different levels of that insight. Freedom being full enlightenment, of course. Yeah, but first of all, what happens when you get some kind of insight, there's this sense of happiness that follows, this sense of joy, this sense of freedom, in a way. Not freedom, because that's the last one, but joy. And then that's a deeper level of happiness, of insight, and that's a much deeper level, and this is finally the happiness, complete happiness of enlightenment. So the Buddha was called many things in his life. He was called Buddha, awake. He was called loads of things. In the end, it was the Buddha, the word Buddha, that kind of stuck. And that's what Buddhists are called now. Buddhists, we're followers of the awakened one. But we could have been Sugatists, because the Buddha was also called the Sugata in his time, the happy one. That'd be interesting, wasn't it? The Stockholm Sugatist Centre. The Manchester Sugatist Centre. So he was called the happy one too. So he was called lots and lots of things. So, Sukhavati, the happy land. It's not, Sukhavati is not worldly happiness. It's a combination of the unworldly and the greater unworldly. Yeah, because in the unworldly happiness, the happiness of the jhanas, that's where the gods dwell, the devas of the different realms. Yeah, and the greater than is going beyond the world completely. So pure lands are these eight levels of happiness. Yeah, the unworldly, four levels, and the greater than unworldly, four levels of happiness.
What sutta did you
take
that? Did you say?
Hmm?
What sutta?
Was it? Niramisa. N-I-R. Can you write? I could write it, couldn't I? Okay. Niramisa. It's supposed to be an R, that one there. Niramisa Sutta. I often think of tiramisu, which is a form of happiness, isn't it? Probably unworldly happiness.
I remember you once said in Stockholm that you had a problem with this Sugata, that Buddha was called the Sugata.
Did I?
Yeah, you said that in one of your talks. Ah. You thought it was very... You had a problem with it being very happy, clappy, sort of thing.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
And I find that quite interesting, since you are so into Sukhavati.
Yeah. I think my problem was the idea of happy, clappy. This idea that... the problem with talking about happiness all the time is... it's okay as long as you realise the levels. But there can be a danger. Do you remember, did you ever see that very interesting, there was a meeting of eminent Buddhists in, I think it was Berlin, a long, long time ago. Well, 10, 15 years ago. And it was the European Buddhist Union meeting, maybe. And there was Thich Nhat Hanh, of course, and Ayakema. And I think, what's the Tibetan who wrote the Book of Living and Dying? Sogyal Rinpoche was there. And Bante, our teacher, was there. They were all there. And there was a panel discussion, people asking. And on that panel were Sangharakshita, Thich Nhat Hanh, and a couple of others. I can't remember who the others were. A Zen and a Tibetan, I think. And, you know, people in the audience were just asking questions, and different one of the four would answer. Anyway, somebody said, someone asked some question, and Thich Nhat Hanh said what one of his main teachings, Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings, is be happy. Yeah. And he was talking about that, you know, the main thing is just to be happy. Sangharakshita, Bante, said, I have to disagree with that. Have you ever seen that? It is really remarkable. He said, I'm sorry, but I have to disagree with that. We can't always be happy. But we can always be friendly. Yeah. So Bante's making a distinction there between Vedana and Karma. Yeah. Vedana is feeling. And there are three kinds of feeling in Buddhism. There's dukkha, and there's sukha, and then there's adukkha sukha. A is a negative prefix, so neither happy nor unhappy. It's somewhere in between. So dukkha, sukha, adukkha sukha. And it's what happens to us. Yeah. Sometimes it's what happens to us as a result of our previous actions. And sometimes it's what happens to us as a result of other people's actions. And sometimes it's what happens to us as a result of whatever the world, the universe decides to do. Yeah, decides to make us have a horrible winter and no summer. This happened in England a couple of years ago. No, horrible winter, no summer. Everyone's unhappy. It's the world did that to us. So it's kind of passive. Karma is your action, whether it's body, speech or mind. So karma. So in saying that, in disagreeing with Thich Nhat Hanh, Bante was, he didn't say this, but he was making that age-old Buddhist distinction between Vedana and karma. You can't always be happy, but you can always be friendly, no matter what you're feeling like. So it's a very important distinction there. So I suppose my problem when I was giving that talk with happiness is that we need to understand it in its depth, and it can be understood very superficially. We need to be happy. What's wrong with you? And, you know, snap out of it. You're unhappy. But sometimes we do need to go down into the underworld of our being, don't we? Sometimes we need to feel grief. Sometimes we need to feel very unhappy. It's almost as if we need to go down into ourselves in order to. There's this wonderful poem by David White, which I've got on here. This isn't really the talk that I meant to give, but I've got it in here, so I'll read it to you, because it's important, I think. Dharmagiri. Poetry. David White. Oh, it's a Word doc. This is an Apple, so it's going to take about a minute. Apples don't like Word docs, so they've got this reluctance to let them come up on the screen. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear. Turning down through its black water. Oh, hold on a minute. It's just, this is another thing that Macs do to Word. It's just messed it up. Yeah. Turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, we'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear. nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Poems don't always work first time, do they? So let me just read it again. It's called The Well of Grief. Secret?
Secret.
I thought you must know the word secret. Glimmering? Do you know the word glimmering? Yeah. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Do you have this in this country? In England, you get wishing wells. You throw coins and you have a wish. You wish for something other than what you've got. And there's all these coins down there. Yeah. So this poem kind of plays with that idea. You have to go down into the, right down into the depths of your being, to grief maybe, whatever, to find the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Brilliant, brilliant. So that's that. My problem with happiness is we think of it as all, oh yes, lovely, haha, and Buddhists are all happy, but a little bit superficial, yeah. And we need to be careful of superficiality. So we mustn't be afraid of going down into whatever our mind brings up, the depth, because unless you go into the depth of your whole being, you're not really going to be able to go into jhana. Okay, so that took me off on a completely different tangent. And it's nearly time to finish, isn't it? It's nearly time for our tea break. So there's a lot more to say. I'm just wondering how to end here, because we're nowhere near where I thought we would be now. Okay. Joy, happiness, equanimity and freedom. Levels of happiness. Maybe that can be our ending theme. And of course, William Blake, his poem Eternity. Amita. Yeah. He who binds to himself a joy, does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies, lives in eternity's sunrise. Yeah. Winged, winged, yeah, wings. He who binds to himself a joy, when you hold something, yeah, to yourself, you've got this little happiness, just keep it now, does the winged life to destroy. Once you've hung on to something, you can't fly anymore. But he who kisses the joy as it flies, lives in eternity's sunrise. Sukhavati is eternity's sunrise. Yeah. It's the happiness of letting go completely of self-clinging. Yeah. Sukhavati is not one of the heavens. Yeah. Sukhavati is not heaven. It's not something that Buddhists try to get into so they can live as they are for the rest of eternity. The eternity is the timeless state, not time prolonged forever. Yeah. So Amita is measureless. You cannot measure time. Yeah. So Sukhavati is to live within the realm of the Dharma completely. Beyond time, beyond space, beyond categories, beyond attachment to anything whatsoever. How do we get there? We haven't got time to talk about that now. But you've heard one thing at least. Part of it is to let go of whatever it is you're currently attached to, whatever happiness, pleasure, sense of security you've got from hanging on to something, someone, hanging on to yourself for dear life, you know, you just have to let it go. So part of our practice on this retreat is to just relax a little bit. Yeah, just let go a little bit. Let things happen.
Just thinking that the let go also applies then to anger, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, although you need to go down, deep down, but you also cling to.
You do, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Vedana. You know, you need to go right into your Vedana. That's why this afternoon we're just going to go out and just be. Just be in the world of the senses. Yeah. Finish with another poem, I think. We'll finish with a poem by Kamala Sheela. Where are we? Poetry. This is a lovely poem. First I have to find it, which may take a little time. Here we are. PDF, so it won't take long. Holiday. Do you know it?
Yeah.
Take a holiday. Take a holiday from being someone. Take a holiday from being somewhere. Take a holiday from it being a time. Take a holiday from it being now. Take a break from wanting things. A holiday from hopes. Let things not happen after all. Take a break from fearing things. Let the universe do what it pleases. It will anyway. The universe is having a holiday. Why not you? So, well, that's a good place to finish, isn't it?